Lunch with Leon.
So hello and welcome to another edition of Lunch with Leon, a rare example of one on video. We're doing this on YouTube as well as on audio. So welcome to Lunch with Leon. Hope you enjoy it. And my guest today is Sam Mullins. Sam is with me today because he is the author of the new book commemorating 25 years of Transport for London. So Sam, you're really very welcome indeed. Thanks very much indeed for joining us. Your journey started longer than 25 years ago, right?
Yes. Well, I'm a historian. I've worked in museums all my life. And I like to think that, you know, I've always been interested in history. From, you know, when I was a boy, I read a history book. That was the book that I was most interested in. And I can remember, you know, saying to my parents or whoever around me at the time, oh, you know, did you know that Napoleon, you know, Jena in 1809 did this, that, and the other, you know? So I don't think it's fanciful to think that that's working in museums is actually about knowing your history, but actually also being committed to sharing it and exhibiting it and talking about it and explaining it to people. So it sort of comes instinctively to me, Leon, I think.
Indeed. And so where was your first remunerative work in
Well,
history?
My first job was in Much Winlock, Shropshire.
Wonderful place.
I picked up the job because someone else had dropped it at short notice. And I remember very early on, this was a new museum that had been set up by a community group and volunteers. And I was the first professional curator. I'd done my Leicester University Museum Studies course and I knew how to run a museum. You know, I'd done the course. And I was walking down the street one day and the mayor, who was a retired greengrocer, this is a parish council museum, said, well, you know what you've got to do, young man, don't you? You have to right the wrongs of the foundation of the Olympics. And he said, Baron Pierre de Coubertin has taken all the credit for the modern Olympics, but actually our man, Dr. William Penny Brooks, has been cut out of the story and you've got to tell that story. And I kind of thought, you know, silly old fool's got it all around, you know, the wrong way. Actually, by the time I left 3 or 4 years later, it was true. Brooks had set up Olympic Games in Shropshire in the 1850s. He'd corresponded with de Coubertin, who arguably got the idea about medals and odes to the victor and all the ceremony of the Olympics, which, you know, we've seen on the snow in the last couple of weeks. That's what he took from a visit to a wet Wenlock Olympic Games just before Brooks died in the early 1890s. So that was my first job. So I found myself going to the British Olympic Association Education Committee and been sent as their delegate to the Olympic Academy at Olympia in Greece. Great start.
That's a great way to start a career, actually. That's tremendous. So what happened after that?
Well, then Shropshire was a great place to live. I really loved living in Shropshire. And I then got a job developing a new museum in Market Harborough in Leicestershire, which was a three-way split between the county and the district. And again, a local society. And they were setting up a brand new museum in a former corset factory that the district council were converting into offices. So my job was a year and a week later to open a brand new museum talking about the story of a small market town in South Leicestershire. And in that, I did quite a lot of oral history because the collection was pretty small because it had been gathered together by a local society for many years. I took the view that actually the best way to kind of get this new institution on the move was to interview people and do kind of 20th century topics. This was 1983 when the museum opened. So we did oral history programs. We turned them into little tape slideshows in the gallery. You know, produced a book, and then next year we did another topic. So we did a one on domestic life in Market Harborough. We did domestic service. Did ones on shops and shopkeeping. So that was the kind of the method for a brand new kind of community museum. But it was important for me because it demonstrated to me the kind of power of oral history's personal accounts of the recent past.
And this is modern stuff for the period, right? Because museums traditionally were full of artifacts in glass cases with captions.
Yeah, yeah. I was, you know, I was part of there was a kind of movement in museums in the 70s and 80s of young, so particularly social historians who thought that, you know, the glass case approach was, you know, only took you so far. And what you really need to do is personalize the story and to get the community, you know, involved in it. It's almost a truism now. Then it was regarded as pretty radical, I think. Yeah.
You've never struck me as a radical, but congratulations anyway. And that stood you in good stead for what happened after that, presumably.
Yes. My next job was in St. Albans, where I was director of museums. Two museums, a history museum and Verulamium, which is on the site of Roman St. Albans, the third largest city in Roman Britain, a museum set up by in the 1930s, a museum that desperately needed a dose of storytelling to it. It was one of those old-fashioned museums that you just talked about where there were exhibits in cases and they had, you know, had a label on it like Tesserae Type 4 Insular X1V brackets B, you know, closed brackets. And I remember saying to the archaeologists who were terribly proud of all this that, you know, we had to do a little bit better. So we reworked Verulamium Museum as the kind of through the kind of social historian's lens. And then times were tough in the early 90s in local authority funded museums. Money ran out. It was just before the lottery came along in 95. I had designed a wonderful new entrance for the Verulamium Museum, circular building, flint work, beautifully done with a really talented architect, but we couldn't find the money to do it. And my successor eventually built it because the lottery came along and did it. So in 94, I was tempted to take the job of director of London Transport Museum, turning up at 55 Broadway, 8 o'clock in the morning to do some verbal reasoning test, you know, when I barely had a coffee, interviewed twice for the job and thought this might be quite interesting.
So you did it for 28 years, is that right?
28 years, yeah, from 94 until I retired in late 2023.
Which is extraordinary. So London Transport Museum, which has only ever had three chief executives then, because...
Four, I think, with me, yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Which is tremendous. On that wonderful site in Covent Garden, which London Transport had the chance to buy the freehold of decades ago and decided not to, which is a pity.
Mm. I think they could have had it for 10 or 12 million.
I think so. Yeah. Extraordinary. And the museum, which reopened in its current form in March 1980, but has had a couple of refurbishments since then. And the big one, which we did, which we were all involved in, weren't we, back in 2007, which involved a big closure. And that's quite a radical thing to do. Fabulous footprint in the centre of London, closed to the public.
Two and a bit years.
Wow.
Yes, I think you wouldn't get away with it today. It was a huge, huge task, both increasing the kind of footprint for the museum within the building and sorting out things like putting photovoltaics on the roof, which was regarded as pretty new at that date, and then reworking the entire story within the museum, because TfL had come into existence in 2000. So being the London Transport Museum and not talking about taxis and, you know, private hire and the river and all the, you know, the new functions which TfL take on from London Transport was in danger of making the museum look just like an anachronism. I can remember when Ken was elected in 2000, I took some advice from someone who actually became a board member later and said, what should we do about, you know, the new mayor? And he said, just give him something to open in the first couple of weeks. And, you know, he'll lose interest after that. You know, there'll be bigger things to do, which, as you well know, there certainly were. So we convinced the transitional bit of Transport for London that we could introduce free admission for children, which was going to cost a couple of hundred thousand. And in all that, those transitional arrangements between LT and TfL, you know, that just got lost in roundings, really. So Ken turned up in the middle of week two. He announced that the museum was going free for children. We never saw him again, I don't think, other than for a few openings and so forth. But yeah, it had done the job. And as you know, keeping kind of some hold on one end of the elastic with the politicians, and using that, you know, both freedom and restriction at times was the kind of both the story of the museum and the story of TfL.
Indeed so. And it is interesting, isn't it? Because the earliest iterations of transport museums, thinking back to Clapham and so on, was simply the glass case scenario we discussed earlier. The vehicles were parked in long lines. You walk down the lines. They had captions involving horsepower or something. And that was it. And the London Transport Museum has morphed not only into a story that is full of art, posters, social history, as well as the heavy engineering and the other things. It's done all that on the back of weaning itself off quite a sizable grant from TfL, and has replaced quite a lot of that grant with its own commercial income and sponsorship and so on. That was a huge move, wasn't it, over the years?
Yes. We became a charity just after we reopened in 2007. And actually the American management of TfL in those days, Jay Walder, thought it was why don't we do it? Because he saw, as in the American model, huge tax advantages, which of course they weren't. The advantages were all in governance, having a dedicated board only interested in promoting the interests of delivering the purpose of the charity, rather than always kind of being the tail end Charlie within a big organization. It was good place to be. And you're absolutely right. A lot of the museum's success comes from being very clear in 2008 what the museum did do and kind of what it didn't do. Redefining the relationship with Transport for London meant we were quite clear what they did for us and what we did for them. And for a while, we kind of quite deliberately kept ourselves quite well apart. But the particularly the 150th anniversary of the Tube early in 2013 was the moment when, in a sense, we kind of understood each other much better and came back together. And in the run up to that, Peter Hendy was the commissioner. And he, of course, was hugely enthusiastic to restore a steam engine and take it to Moorgate and, do exhibitions and use the museum as a kind of advocational platform for TfL. And we developed this notion that the museum was about not only about the, reflecting the past, but also explaining the present and having a look at where the future might be. And that sort of sense of the continuum between sort of the past, the present, and the future, one informing the other, was the right positioning, I think, for the museum. And I remember Peter saying after the steam runs to Moorgate, he said, I've always been a big fan of the museum. He said, but now all my leadership team get why we have a museum too.
That was a great success. I'd always thought of the museum as TfL's best shop window. Everything that was good about the organisation and how it had got to be what it was and why it did the things that it did were just on display, which was tremendous. I think people often don't realise how valuable the roundel is because it broadly says, wherever you put it up, this is safe, insured, regulated, the staff are trained, there's a process behind it. You don't need to know what it is, but it's all right. And the museum exploits that beautifully, doesn't it? Because the roundel itself is a great symbol and people love it with T-shirts and hats and so on. Then there's all the subtle use of the logo and the subtle use of the typeface and everything else that sits behind it. And there's the museum broadly saying, do you know, this organisation isn't built on sand. This organisation is built on a couple of hundred years now worth of extraordinary history, bravery, people digging tunnels, braving the weather, doing all sorts of great things. So I've always thought the museum was this great advocate for the organisation that says, don't worry too much about how it works. Just be assured it works really very well. And here is how some of these things got to be done, which is why the social history was so important, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think that's right, because it's storytelling. It's not just, here's an interesting bus and it's, 40 horsepower and was built in 1910, which is actually what we did at Clapham. Even when the museum opened in Covent Garden in 1980, it had the kind of story of transport kind of around the edge and the vehicles in the middle. And the big refurb that we did in 2007 took that many steps, further forward, and we focused on particularly on people's stories, people that ran transport in the past, as well as in the present. So you're right, in a way the museum is a sort of reflection of both the brand and in its storytelling is also the kind of barometer for where London, where transport sits within London.
Yeah, indeed. Which brings us then neatly to the book, which of course was originally envisaged as 20 years of TfL, was it not? There was just some pandemic got in the way of the process.
Something happened in 2020. I'm gone. Mine's a complete blank about it. We had begun to think that it might be interesting to do something to mark 20 years. Because I think even at 20 years, TfL had survived longer than any other transport agency since 1930.
Without a doubt. And I think apart from that wobble in 2020, everybody was ready for it to be reinvented. So, of course, you and I have this statistic off pat, whether it was 1933, 1948, 1969, 1984, and then 1999 into TfL. So it was due for replacement because in its history, really back since before the war, its history was one of shuttling between local and central government. And as one got fed up with it, it got given to the other. And vice versa. Then local government mismanaged it and it went back to central government. And then, of course, in the big push that we have to credit London First and Tony Travers and a number of other luminaries of the time, the pushing for a greater London authority, the restoration of local government in London. And it was natural that transport would go into it. So the book picks up the story, doesn't it, as TfL gets formed. A pretty tricky birth, bringing together more than just the underground and the buses, bringing together a whole lot of other stuff as well. So much so that as the book tells the story, the underground didn't even come in 2000.
No, indeed. Yes. Well, I think, you know, the first chapter in the book looks at that period when there wasn't London-wide governance and what a mess it was. And you're right that sort of London First business were advocating really hard for a more strategic approach to planning across London and to the delivery of transport, and a number of people did some really important work in the 90s. This, you know, the heavy lifting and the spade work to create what becomes the GLA. I think devolution comes in on the back of Tony Blair being really concerned about devolution for Scotland. And so the provision of, concerned about Scottish nationalism and the, you know, potential for breakup of the UK. So devolution becomes a thing. I don't think London ever featured particularly big in his thinking. It's dismissed in like a line in the autobiography. He was more concerned about devolution for Edinburgh and for Cardiff at that stage. But it does give London devolved mayoral, an elected mayor for the first time. In its history, and most crucially, as you will recall, you've got funding and powers which are coterminous with the electoral district, and you've got transport, which, you know, within the M25, within the GLA area, all comes under the integrating influence of the mayor and his executive.
Indeed, and it is interesting. We mustn't forget TfL was really well funded at the start. One of the things governments do to make sure that devolution works is to fill it full of money. It's over a period that the funding gets taken away. But in fact, TfL was very well funded because it had to be a success. It had to do better than the Government Office for London had previously been able to do. And I remember at the first TfL board meeting where I went to in the audience, Ken Livingstone said, "This is an auspicious day." And broadly, he said something like, "This is the time when the public takes control of transport in London and we take the lid off the box and we peer into the dark corners and find out what it's all about." Yeah. Just pure Ken,
yeah,
brilliantly executed. And it was true because, you know, there was a time in London Transport's history that the board considered moving the HQ to Brighton because it would have been easier for them to get there. And the idea of actually the public and the politicians asking how this stuff worked and why it worked and what was, and joining it into planning, joining it into spatial planning, joining it into business and so on, was really unheard of. The old days of London Transport that I can recall were ones where the door at 55 Broadway was firmly shut and you weren't invited in because it was all too difficult, and just leave it to us and it'll all be all right. So the story in the book is about how the lid was taken off the box and the light started to pour in. Mm. And they say, you know, about sunlight being the greatest antiseptic. It cleaned out a whole load of stuff in there that had been bubbling away for quite some time. What I especially love about the book is how it characterizes the arrival of the Americans, which became a sort of 14th floor enclave, which you describe in the book. And that was an extraordinary period, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. And I was within the organization, but in a relatively lowly position. And there is a great quote in the book, which I think is from Mike Swiggs, which is, you know, very embittered about the arrival of the Americans, and they're all kind of sitting around with their feet on the desks, reading the New York Times and talking about the baseball over the weekend, you know, having sort of just flown in. It's hard to kind of remember the impact of that, because a lot of people from London Transport days didn't join TfL. They kind of had seen the writing on the wall. Ken had been pretty clear, hadn't he, in the run-up to the election that he hadn't got a particularly high opinion of the people who'd run London Transport.
In fact, he called them the dullards.
The dullards, blockheads and dullards. Yeah. So the writing was on the wall for, you know, the London Transport gang, who had actually done a lot of pretty good work in the 90s under Dennis to turn the turn the tanker around. But the arrival of the Americans was extraordinary. And I think it would be easy to think them, you know, this great, great gang of people who'd all worked together, you know, before arriving. Some of them were. Some had worked with Kylie in New York when he ran EMTA. But others came in, you know, kind of fairly randomly. I mean, Tim O'Toole had not known Kylie beforehand. I think it's more a kind of opening of the floodgates to real talent that came from around the world. You know, Ken boasted, didn't he, that he had employed the best.
Yes. He famously says in the book, "I'm not going to advertise the commissioner's job in The Guardian or some other left-wing rag.
Yep.
I want this in the Sunday Times where clever people are going to read it," which is just outstanding. And Ken was so good at that, wasn't he? Ken was really great at that. And he knew that he wasn't going to promote internally. He was going to get a gang of people in who were going to really drive this forward. Mm. And I think when they arrived, the book, you know, tells all this story, and they were immediately thrust into the whole underground PPP thing, which was already started to come apart. And eventually, I mean, you tell the story about how Kylie was summoned to Chequers and Tony Blair is trying to fathom out the PPP contracts. And Kylie ends up effectively negotiating on behalf of the government, which is extraordinary.
Yes, it was kind of a weird moment when, I mean, it was quite clear, it had become clearer and clearer that PPP was not a great idea, it wasn't going to fly very successfully, but that Gordon Brown was utterly determined that it should happen. And there are a couple of really interesting moments. One of the senior civil servants responsible for it convened a meeting with Gordon's advisor, who after, you know, on Sunday morning, secretly somewhere, who after, you know, talking about it for a couple of hours, conceded, yes, that it wasn't a very good idea, but I'm afraid Gordon wants it. Yeah. You know, so, you know, Gordon got it. And you're right. Tony Blair famously took the PPP contracts, you know, over to Chequers at the weekend as a lawyer, looked through them and couldn't make head and tail of it, allegedly.
Indeed. And the PPP is a perfect example of something we've seen quite a lot of in this period, which is broadly a contractual mechanism that goes on for thousands of pages designed to cope with every eventuality. And another document of several thousand pages, which is the dispute resolution mechanism for all the things that it doesn't cover, which actually means the lawyers and the accountants get very rich and the people who are trying to make the whole thing work are in this snowstorm of paperwork. Now, I well remember in my time the big argument on Croydon Tramlink, which, of course, was a consortium for the construction and for the operation and so on. You know, and there was piles and piles of correspondence arguing whether the replacement of the points at Therapia Lane Depot was caused by misuse by the operating department, poor design by Bombardier for the design of the tram, poor design in respect of the infrastructure itself, or some other reason. Mm-hmm. And, of course, this argument went on for months, simply because something was wearing out and all the parties concerned were trying to offload the cost into one of the other parties so they didn't have to pay for it.
Yeah. And the last person in the queue was the customer.
Indeed, sir. Indeed. The other thing I love in the book, because there's some names that we, to our shame, had forgotten, and I'm thinking Derek Turner,
yes,
who, of course, was the had previously been the traffic director for London, so was absorbed into TfL. He got the job of introducing congestion charge. But before he got there, and you rightly remind us in the book, he got absolute acclaim for pedestrianising the north side of Trafalgar Square, which nobody in their right mind would undo now, because it turned what effectively was a urban motorway of fast-moving multi-lane traffic going round and round Trafalgar Square into a beautiful place for pedestrians and streets. And, I mean, I think the book describes the World Squares project and Trafalgar Square for Derek as a career high moment, because
so the man who introduced congestion charge, when asked, said actually Trafalgar Square was a bigger moment actually in his career, because Westminster had given up on trying to do it. You know, endless consultation had happened, and you know, no one could ever possibly agree. So it was a kind of great moment for the new mayoral governance to kind of ride in and say, we're going to do this, come hell or high water. And it was TfL's first big triumph. I think that's also why it was terribly important.
It was.
It's hard to remember, but you've got the 90s. London Transport shipped a lot of water over overrun on the Jubilee line, but then it's a great railway. No one regrets building it now. Here was a transport initiative that had been delivered on time and on budget, and of course congestion charge follows up the
it
year
does.
After that. Similarly successful, and everyone's slightly shell-shocked for the fact that there was no good copy. If you remember in the weeks beforehand, there was amazing coverage in the papers about how London was going to grind to a halt, and they kind of found photographs of the embankment at 4 o'clock on a Sunday morning to how it was going to be in the future. And then it worked, and it worked rather well.
It did. And in fact, I think in the book we have the front page of the Evening Standard on the day that it was launched. Desperate for copy because it just seemed to be working all right. But in fact, it is the story, of course, is that even Ken was wobbling on the run-up to congestion charging. He starts to make some statements about how, if it doesn't work, we might take it out. And I think he says, we won't put the price up for 5 years. And indeed, Derek himself doesn't survive terribly long in TfL after the introduction of the congestion charge. And then that whole streets thing was merged into surface transport, which Peter Hendy had, and then David Brown had, and then I had, and so on. And it was interesting that these big bold moves, even when they were successful, they claimed a few scalps on the way through, because to be brave, sometimes there are casualties.
Yeah. Well, we haven't seen congestion charge introduced significantly in any other European city on the scale of London's relatively modest, central London scheme.
Not forgetting the Western Extension, which gives London an extra attribute, which is that not only has it introduced congestion charging and extended it, it's the only authority ever to have taken one out.
Yes.
Because Boris famously had the Western Extension taken back out again.
But you're right in that Ken's advisors all were saying to him, I think this is too big, you're taking too big of a, too big a risk. I think you should drop it.
Yeah.
I think he had deliberately pushed the timetable so that if he had to drop it, he had another year left of his mayoral term to row back across in some way.
Sure.
And then Derek Turner walked down Victoria Street on the day it was introduced and saw there was absolutely no traffic and did ask himself whether they'd been too successful.
Yes, indeed.
Of course, it settled
of
after
course.
That.
Which, of course, it always does.
Yeah.
We mustn't forget to talk about the Olympics, because you write extensively in the book about the Olympics. Probably London at its finest in our recent past, and struggling to think of anything as exciting as 2012 over the last 15, 16 years. And one, of course, under Ken, the terrible business of the great elation of the announcement on the 6th of July, followed by the terrible tragedy of the 7th of July. Again, in the book, we capture that, don't we, just about how London goes from one One extreme to another overnight.
The two Evening Standard front pages, yeah. Yes. Elation in Trafalgar Square and then the 7-7 the day afterwards.
Yeah, terrible. Extraordinary. Yeah. And there's some lovely stories in the book about how Mike Brown and others commandeered a police boat in order to get back from, I think, Canary Wharf.
They're having an away day at Canary Wharf.
Yeah, indeed.
Without Tim, who was the MD. And yes, they had to commandeer a police boat to get back to headquarters to kind of manage what was still an unknown situation.
Yeah. And so for me, the lovely thing about the book is all the human stories, as we might expect from somebody like you, that the human stories that are behind it, because the way in which transport operates is all about humans, isn't it? Because the humans are the passengers and the humans are the workforce that's delivering it. And the terrible shock about what's going on 7-7 has a real effect on real people, and not just people in the vicinity, but the people with the responsibility for delivering. The book tells the story. There was a new gold commander running the underground control center on 7-7, but fortunately had Andy Barr close at hand. And so there's all the tales of all of the work and so on that that went through 7-7. And then as we repaired ourselves after that, we got into the groove for the Olympics. So there, of course, is Boris in charge, recently elected into his second term. He might not have been the mayor during the Olympics because the election was in May 2012.
Yeah.
So Boris, newly elected, on the crest of a wave, having had a very successful election. And there, the story, which again you tell in the book, is that for most of us involved in the Olympics, we had nothing to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it must have been an extraordinary period for people like you. I mean, you talk in my interview with you about the endless preparation that had gone on for years, you know, planning the Olympic transport strategy, which, you know, actually rolled out and worked like a dream. And we were, you know, probably lucky in that we didn't get a, you know, random broken rail or, you know, some other incident that kind of got in the way. I think you talk about the biggest problem is getting people to stop planning and actually do it.
It's very hard to get their hands off. They'd still be planning it now.
Yeah, yeah. But it was the high point, wasn't it? I think of London in our time.
Yeah.
And I look back on, you know, the Golden Saturday, you know, the way that the kind of country all kind of got behind the athletes and the Olympics, and the way London functioned in the most extraordinary fashion through all the weeks of the Olympics and then the Paralympics afterwards. I look back with a bit of nostalgia those years now.
Well, most people in the world don't get a chance to work on an Olympic Games. We were lucky. We were at a point in our professional careers when the Olympic Games were with us to do, which was just extraordinary. So it was a wonderful thing. And I do remember one of the things I was very strong about was to make sure that as many of our young people as possible, our aspiring senior managers, got some jobs to do during the Olympics. Mm. Because this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to learn to do things, which is just tremendous. Mm. So finally, Sam, I mean, must ask you, you conducted years worth of interviews with the great and the good. And you as a historian had a fabulous knowledge of the organization and how it got to be where it is. What was it that really surprised you about the organization when you came to hear it firsthand from those who were there?
I was you know, in a unique position, really. I've been in the organization, sort of one foot in TfL and one foot in the museum for years. I knew lots of people and I was kind of trusted to do those interviews. So people, you know, weren't holding back. And so there's some material which is held back from, you know, from the book, which will go into people's memoirs in the future.
It'll be in mine for sure.
Yours, I'm sure. So when I came to retire, I kind of felt obliged to finish, actually. It would have been criminal to sort of leave it halfway because no one else was in the kind of fortunate position I was in to finish it off. I guess one of the things that is slightly surprised me afterwards is that in the month leading up to the publication of the book, I sent chapters out to you and lots of people who'd been, you know, major contributors to them, and they were extraordinarily kind of helpful and came back to me saying, well, actually, looking at our past and kind of reflecting on it was actually quite therapeutic, because I think, you know, TfL is a day-to-day organisation. You know, if you don't get the bus fleet out in the morning and the trains don't run on the Piccadilly line, you know, the mayor is on your case. You know, the accountability point that you made right at the front of this, you are very accountable. You know, for what you do, and that tends to, I think, mean that, you know, you're on that perpetual 24-hour, you know, kind of cycle, and opportunities to kind of reflect back, let alone to look right across, you know, the whole organisation, were kind of relatively few and far between. And that was one of the responses from a lot of the people I talked to, who all then found something across the organisation in the book. They didn't know that actually, didn't know it happened, you know, that way, because, you know, TfL is a big, indeed, big beast.
Indeed. Well, you know, I used to refer to the times we spent together as therapy, because I'd come and lie on your couch on a Tuesday afternoon and feel better afterwards having got this off my chest. So it's a great service you did to all of us. So Sam, we're going to wrap it up there. Thank you very much. So I've been talking to Sam Mullins, who is the author of Every Journey Matters, the 25 Years of Transport for London, published by Paul Holberton Publishing. You will absolutely enjoy the book, because it's not about wheels, it's not about vehicles, it's not about anything but the people who travel, the people who make it work, the politicians, the social fabric and evolution of the time. You will absolutely enjoy every part of it. Lunch with Leon is produced in association with Passenger Transport Magazine. Please do take a look at passengertransport.co.uk for all of your up-to-date transport news. And as for Lunch with Leon, we'll be back with another episode very soon. In the meantime, my great thanks to my good friend and the author of Every Journey Matters, Sam Mullins.
Thank you, Leon. Great pleasure to be here.
Leon Daniels was having lunch with Sam Mullins, author of Every Journey Matters, published by Paul Holberton Publishing, available online also at the London Transport Museum, the London Bus Museum at Brooklands, and at good bookshops. The machine behind Lunch with Leon is Stark Communications, and it is published in association with Passenger Transport Magazine. This episode is also available on video on YouTube, on Leon Daniels' YouTube channel.